Welcome to Money and Racism, the podcast that delves deep into the intersection of finance and racial disparities. I'm your host and money EQ specialist, Dr. Joe Burns. I'm here to guide you through a series of thought-provoking conversations with people of color that aim to uncover the intricate relationships between money and systemic racism. Whether you're curious about the subject, seeking insights, or ready to join the fight against systemic injustices, money and racism is your space to learn, discuss, and take action. So, join us every week as we engage in free-flowing conversations that challenge the status quo and encourage critical thinking. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world. On today's episode, we have Ant Blair. He's a former street entrepreneur, has successfully transitioned into the mainstream entrepreneurial world with an impressive track record as a six-time public speaking champion and a two-time TEDx presenter. Blair not only captivates audiences, but also helps people overcome their fear of public speaking. Blair firmly believes that now is an unprecedented time in history for African Americans to assert their rights and seize economic opportunities. His inspiring story serves as the access code to unlock the promises of America for African American, Black, and Brown individuals. In addition to his entrepreneurial pursuits, Blair is a certified life coach and an ordained minister. His multifaceted expertise enables him to empower others on their journey towards personal and spiritual growth. Help me welcome Ant Blair today.
Hey, Ant, man, I'm so happy to have you on here today. Man, I appreciate you so much. Thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, same. You know, we met in that mastermind group, and you're one of the people out of the mastermind group who I try to keep up with as much as I can. There's a few folks that I keep up with, and you're one of them. And it was good to reconnect a few weeks ago and learn about what you're doing here with Money and Racism. And I've been looking forward to this day ever since we said, let's go ahead and do this thing.
I love it. It's been a crazy journey so far. You know, with people saying yes, I've been surprised about some of the guests I'm having on the show. It's not really about me, right? And I can ask for better content for people to share their stories and what they're showing up with. I mean, I'm learning stuff about people I've known for years, right? Mm-hmm. In these conversations. And so it's been a lot of good. And man, I always love talking to you. You always bring a new perspective, a new fresh perspective. One thing I've really always enjoyed about our conversations is you always help me challenge my own beliefs. When we're talking about racism, right, from a white dude like me and a Black man like you, there's a lot that could go wrong in those conversations. I haven't heard this. I came up with this as talking to somebody before, but like my own fragile beliefs. There's a book out there called White Fragility, but I kind of think my own fragile beliefs and being able to have the conversation, and not that you got to hold any of that, but that you can like meet me where I'm at, which has always been really cool. So I've always appreciated that about you. And just the passion you bring for not only this subject, but for life itself. It's always refreshing talking to you.
I appreciate that, man. And you know, Joe, I've always said, especially over the, well, really since the pandemic and George Floyd and all that, we just have to sit down and have some discussions that actually lead to productive actions. And that's what I appreciate about you. I know that you've been wrestling with, how do I insert myself into this? Where's my place in this? The result of the wrestling is what we're doing right now. I think it's some of it, you know, and you've taken some classes and things like that. So I appreciate the fact that you try to bone up on as much information as you can. And because of that, you make it easy to meet you where you are. And I believe that's part of it. I hear people who want to, you know, dismantle racism and be anti-racist and all of the things. They get the books and they read. And you do the book clubs and all the things. And then what? What's that action that goes with, or the next action that comes from the knowing? And for me, Joe, that's been ever since I did my TEDx talk, ever since George Floyd and all of those things, I've always been the person who says, well, what next? What next? What next? And what do we do next? What do we do next? And honestly, it's been a source of heartburn because I remember civil rights, not that I was around, but, you know, I watched the stories and I hear am I and whatnot, you know, it wasn't like I was actually, you know, on the street marching and whatnot. But, you know, I hear them talk about that period of time, and even people who I didn't know that I've bumped into since that TEDx talk who talk about, yeah, when we marched, the action. The actual tangible action of uniting and organizing and accomplishing a goal. You know, I look at civil rights, Joe, and I'm like, man, Are you kidding me? Rumor has it that about 250,000 people were involved in the civil rights movement. So let's just say it was, let's just even say it was double that. Let's say it was 500,000 people. 500,000 people over the course of 11 years made historic change. And I look at today and I'm like, what's next? Why are we still in that lane? Why are we not still in that mode to where literally times, not saying the times are great now, but back then for them to do what they did, man, that is remarkable. That's remarkable. And I'm like,
it's pretty crazy. Like, I didn't know that, right? And thinking of that number. But you think about that, it's like, man, that was that many people. What happens if we could enroll more people now and actually like keep working? Because I'm with you. I'm all about the action. Like, let's do something. Now, for my own journey, sometimes I understand as a white man in America, like there was a lot I've really held off on and I've tried to really listen and learn for a while. I mean, my journey's been like 4 years now since I really dove into anti-racism work and just learning and trying to understand what, you know, I could learn from Google, but I didn't know. There's a lot I didn't know. Much different now, and I'm asking different questions now. I think one of the biggest questions I'm asking kind of along these lines is, I would ask, is this racist? You always kind of sit with that. It's like, is this racist, like doing this thing? But now I've learned that everything is pretty much racist, like all the systems and all the things that are happening. So my question now is, how is this racist? It's a little bit of change to the question, but it's no longer inferring, oh, maybe it's not, and really looking and saying, no, it is. Okay, what can we do about it now? Because like you're saying, like, we got to take some action. Yeah, there's been a lot of movement, and I think there needs to be more. Too many people are getting hurt by it. You know what I mean?
100%, Joe. And here's my lament about the whole thing is taking it back to George Floyd. Joe, the whole world was shitty about that. The whole world was on full protest mode, man. So think about civil rights, taking it back there. And I hate to just keep beating that horse, but let's just say that it was 500,000 during that period of time. And really, it was only in America. So, I mean, yeah, it was some pockets around the world where people like, yeah, you know, we stand with the folks who are fighting the fight and whatnot. George Floyd was the freaking entire world damn near.
Yeah,
damn near.
You know, that was pretty impressive to see that the whole world came together and to see the reactions and know that this problem, while it is pervasive in the United States, it's not only here as well, right? It's a multinational cultural issue of importance that we all need to participate in. But that was something to see, like all the protests in the news and everybody kind of locking arms and being like, hey, something's got to change.
And so, Joe, to that point, what changed?
Yeah, here it is. And think about how much everything's cooled off. You don't hear about it anymore. Hardly anybody talks about it. We've just moved on to who knows what else.
Exactly, Joe. And that's my lament. My lament is if 500,000 people in the 60s, where it was freaking Jim Crow and, you know, freaking colored water fountains and, you know, all of the things, a much different time, they were able in 11 years to get two major pieces of legislation, laws changed. And we had the whole world, like you said, locking arms. What major piece of legislation came from that? What major initiative came out of that? What major anything came out of that? And I'm struggling. Maybe I missed the news or whatever the case may be, but I don't know that there's anything that is majorly significant that came out of that whole global protest.
There were small things like that changed, right? But nothing major. Yeah.
Exactly.
Small movements. And people are like, see, we're doing something. But really? Because we're, what, 3 years past now? And nobody can really say, oh, hey, this was a massive thing that changed. We started really digging deep. You even look at corporations that changed a lot of their policies and what they were focusing on. A lot of them are gone. I mean, in a lot of cases, you start looking at this point in the time in America, a lot of corporations are starting to push back on like their DEI programs, starting to defund them, starting to like all this stuff because it's, oh, it's no longer a problem, right? Well, no, we just, the white people choose to forget about it. We whitewash it and then it turns into something that doesn't matter.
Two things to that point, Joe. One is I discovered painfully that, you know, people believe that it doesn't affect them. I read a book that's called The Sum of Us. I don't know if you're hip to that book.
I have not read that book.
I think her first name is Dorothy. I know her last name is McGee, and I think it's like M-C-G-H-E-E. So the premise of the book, she used to work for a think tank. I can't remember where, because it was 2 years ago I read this book. She used to work for a think tank, and she had access to a lot of data. And she asked the question, well, does racism only affect quote unquote black people? I don't call black people black people. I call black people melanated people because I ain't black. I'm a nice shade of chocolate mocha, if you will. She says that based on the data that she was able to pull up, that racism indeed affects, I will say almost everybody. She says everybody. I'm going to say almost everybody. And I could talk about that in a little bit, but she said it affects everybody. And so the cover of the book has a kid jumping into a pool. The story that she opens up with, and I'm not going to get the location and the details right, but the general premise is there was a public swimming pool. I don't know, let's say back in the 50s or 60s, that was a really nice setup. Well, it became integrated and African-American folks come in and they in the pool. They're like, hey, you know, we're in the pool. So then European-Americans, they're like, we don't want y'all in the pool. So it got to be a big old brouhaha. And so guess what happened, Joe?
What happened?
They closed down the pool. They filled up the pool. And now it's grass on top of what used to be a public pool. Her point is, because y'all didn't want the African Americans in the pool, now nobody has a pool. You ain't got a pool. They ain't got a pool because you were being dumb. Nobody has a pool now.
Yeah, they're like, hey, we'll just like take our ball, go home kind of thing, right? We're just like, if we can't have what we want, then nobody will have it, right?
Then nobody have it, but everybody's getting screwed. So nobody's swimming in the pool now. And so that's the premise that she uses to launch into this idea. And she backs it up with a whole bunch of data. It's a really good book. It's a thick one, but it's definitely a good read. And she just breaks it down like, hey, you know, economically, this is how it affects everybody. You know, it doesn't matter where you are on the totem pole. I don't even know if you can say totem pole anymore, but it doesn't matter where you are in the scheme of things. It affects everyone. And I believe that some people don't believe it affects them. And so they kind of remove themselves from the thing like, oh, well, it's not my problem or it's not affecting me. So I don't really have to worry about it. I read a book. So then I can, you know, pat myself on the back, say I did my thing. But
I did something. So, you know, I'm not racist anymore or it's not going to affect me or. Yeah, I get you there.
I'll say this and then lead into the second thing. So tell me anybody today who ain't an OG who already went through it, tell me somebody who's going to go and take that fire hose, take that billy club, take that shield, take that dog bite, you know what I'm saying? Get thrown in the back of a freaking paddy wagon because they believe in what they believe. Representative Lewis bashed up on side of head. He damn near didn't make it.
Yeah.
And can you imagine people back then saying, well, honey, I might not make it home tonight. I might be in jail and I hope we got enough money to bail me out or I just might not make it home at all. People was risking it for the biscuit back then, Joe, and folks at large ain't willing to risk it for the biscuit.
Oh, no, 100% not. If it's not going to be safe and if there's not some way they can, I don't know, there's lots of ways we can talk about this. There's no way they're putting their lives on the line for it. No way.
I'll black out my Instagram photo for a day. I ain't fixing to go march or, you know, anything like that too hardcore. So to that point about marching. So I don't know if I told you when George Floyd jumped off, I was in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
Me and my son, we were hunkered down during the pandemic in the coronavirus epicenter of Michigan, Detroit. Because I figure if the zombies was going to come, you know, me and my kid will be able to, we'll be able to knock them down. We don't watch enough Walking Dead.
Right? You'll be right there, huh?
We'll be right there, man. We know what to do. When George Floyd happened and all the protests jumped off, the Detroit protests, they was off the chain. To the point where I narrowly avoided tear gas. They had the shield. They had the baton. They had the helicopters with the spotlights. Disperse, disperse, disperse. And, you know, all of the things, man. I mean, folks getting shot. It was freaking crazy. People everywhere, Joe. But guess what? all these people, I don't know, it was probably, I don't know, 5,000 people. I mean, in the center of downtown Detroit, at least 5,000 people, all young people too, by the way. I was one of the oldest people that I saw the whole night. We were there from the time that stuff jumped off to about 4:35 o'clock in the morning. And the experience that with my kid was freaking epic. My point is, all those people were together in that one place, just like taking it back to the whole global phenomenon. What I saw, people came together, but there was nobody who said, this is what we want, or this is what we need to be going after. There was no Martin Luther King. There was no leader who could clearly articulate, this is what we want. So then everybody's saying, well, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this. None of it is coordinated. People are protesting in all these different places. Nothing's coordinated. So it's like, okay, you have our attention. What do you want? And nobody could articulate that. And here we are today.
All forgotten about it. Even I think sometimes when we talk about racism and we talk about the funding behind systems that continue to propagate the systems, right? Even when we say what we want, it still doesn't change, right? And this brings me to talk to me about Flint. You were there during when the whole water crisis happened, right?
I wasn't there. My people are still there.
I got some history, so I'm up to speed and the listeners can know too. Is this where you're from? Your parents live there, right?
Yeah, man. So my parents, they still live there in the outskirts. They had a water filtration system put in way before that. Imagine the serendipity behind that. Most of my family is in Flint, like Flint proper. The last time I went home, maybe about 45, 60 days ago, they still, Joe, still to this day, I mean, it's mostly fixed, but it's not completely fixed. And I'm thinking, damn, how long has it been and you still haven't gotten it completely fixed? And people won't even know the results, the real results of that, until maybe another 5-10 years from now. You know, they were talking about the kids who got the lead and the Legionnaire's disease and all that stuff that pops up from that. And they're like, man, we won't know like the mental part of that until those kids get way older up in life. And I'm like, man, are you kidding me? So to your point about the money, I don't know how much you were paying attention when it was a thing on the cover of Time magazine and all that beeswax. People, truckloads of water, man. All kinds of money coming in. Where did it go?
No, I mean, not to fix the infrastructure. The infrastructure took forever to fix. Like you said, it's not even really fixed all the way yet.
Not completely fixed. And people who were responsible for it, I mean, none of them went to jail. When I think about the money part of it, I have to go even way, 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 way back beyond Flint. But I'll say about Flint to answer your question completely. The money, General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, that kind of money, they control things in those places, right? So even with the crack epidemic, you know, when we talk about money, it's like, man, how does that amount of cocaine make its way into little old Flint, Michigan, to where there's literally an epidemic. You know, I remember growing up during that time, Joe, and people were making money, you know, the brothers and sisters, you know, hustling, doing whatever on the street. But man, they weren't making the real money. And again, where does one make or gain access to that much money to bring in that much drug traffic? It certainly ain't the melanated folks that has money like that to bring in. And who benefits from all the money? Like I said, there's some people on the street making money, but the big money, man, that wasn't us.
Yeah. And I mean, if you, like you were saying, if you go way, 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 way back, the history of where a lot of this started is just, I mean, to me, it's sickening and appalling. And I find the history of it fascinating at the same time. You know what I mean? Because you can see what's happened and what continues to happen today in situations like this where we have big disasters. Because I remember when Flint happened. I mean, it's been a long time ago when it was on the cover of Time magazine, right? And it was at all the news stations and all that stuff. And it was like, hey, what are we going to do about this? You know, if we just wait it out long enough, then people will forget. It's kind of like the mentality most people take. We didn't solve the problem right away because it wasn't affecting the rich white people.
100%. I think Flint is, I want to say, like 83-85% African American. And European American folks, they on the outskirts. They like Grand Blanc, Mount Morris, Forest Creek, you know, so they ain't affected. Matter of fact, the township, Flint Township, they're like, we want to change our name from Flint Township because people won't come here because we got Flint in our township. So the European American folks, they're like, we ain't even trying to get down with y'all.
Like, we don't even want to be associated with that. They're just like, no way.
And guess what, Joe? Talk about gentrification. So, of course, people leave because they ain't trying to, you know, get jacked up with the water. So guess who comes in and buys the property?
All the developers, all the people, right? They want that land. And you see that happen over and over, right?
Yep. And that's the money, man. That's the money. The money comes in and takes advantage. And what do they call them? Disaster capitalists. They come in, you know, they buy all of the rundown property and, oh, we're putting up a housing development on there that's going to probably make us like $100 million. You know, we're going to expand the college, expand the campus, put dorms up, and we're going to make more money. I'm looking at this in real time, Joe, because I've seen it from a little kid, you know, when Flint was booming and prosperous to when General Motors left, to when the crack epidemic hit, to the water crisis. And people are like, oh my God, you don't want to go to Flint. You know, it's the murder capital, like 3 years running all of the things. But now people are investing money into it because, I mean, it can't get too much more run down than what it is. And people just coming in and scooping up that land, bulldozing the buildings down, building new shit, and making a crap ton of money.
It's unfortunate, right? Because again, that drives, like, you know, if you look at generational wealth, right? Your parents have been there forever, and they're not going to have anything to leave to anybody, right? There's nothing left. And so then it's like for you, right? You're not being handed down anything. So now what are we talking? Like, you got to try to create something for yourself that maybe you can pass down to your boy. Because it ain't coming from before you, right?
Well, that's not entirely true because before things went south, so when my dad, so there was the great migration, right? From the southern and Virginia states and all that, you know, so my family came up through that migration for the automotive jobs, for the, you know, for the Cummins and the General Motors and the Ford and the Chrysler. Yeah. So my great, great, grandfather worked at Buick. My grandfather worked at Buick. My dad worked at Buick. But when my dad landed at Buick, those were for real, the good old days. Man, Joe, I'm going to tell you this. My dad was making freaking, I looked at one of his pay stubs in like 85 or 86. He's making like $32 an hour in freaking 1986 working in a shop.
Wow. That's good money back then. Yeah.
That's great money back then. So, I mean, my parents, they're not struggling or hurting or anything because if you got in at the right time, General Motors was really good. I mean, my dad's got Cadillac insurance, the whole thing. My friends who are in my age bracket, though, they got in right as General Motors was like, we're not going to give them Cadillac benefits and the pension's going to change. And again, the money squeezing the people so that they can boost the profits and the shareholder value and all of the things. So I'm thankful that my dad didn't have to go through that. But people now, I mean, they're lucky to make $20 an hour after being there 20 years. It's definitely a different landscape. So that's not entirely true is my point. You know, so my folks, they did okay because, you know, the job situation after civil rights, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, it changed for folks up in the North, at least. I don't know about the South, but it changed. It changed. It definitely increased. And I think also, too, Joe, people think that, oh, well, you know, if you're not getting hung from a tree anymore, you're not getting burned from a stake anymore, how bad could it be?
Don't you love that that's where, like, the bar is? Well, there's no lynching, so, I mean,
exactly.
I'm going to say that with a lot of stars and caveats around because I think that the form's just changed. It's no longer hanging from trees, right? But, you know, there's now bullets involved and other stuff.
And not to mention the mental conditioning.
Well, 100%, right? I mean, it's just never ending. And really, that's, I think, the problem we have. And I want to go back to this, right, what I was saying before about, because really, if you look at it, yeah, your dad did well, right? And obviously, with the current state of the car industry and all the manufacturing there, they're continuing to strip away those benefits that so many people got way back before. on that, my wife's grandfather worked, I think it was for Caterpillar. And there was some voluntary, and it was kind of one of those corporate things, right? And kind of along this route of where we start seeing some of this things fall apart, right? And where the corporations are starting to change a lot. But anyways, he worked there for his whole entire career. There were some optional or some voluntary layoffs that were happening. So he decided they were giving away a whole bunch of stuff. And he's like, you know, maybe it's about time I'll do it. And, you know, they gave away the benefits and all that stuff. There were a lot of guys his age that had worked just as long as him, been like, no, we're just going to hold out for a few more years. And shortly after he did a voluntary retirement, there were some mandatory retirements. And those poor guys lost everything.
Wow.
It was like all the stuff that he got, they didn't get near as much. Wow. You know, but back to that, I just want to not get too distracted. I go on tangent sometimes, right? But going back to that generational wealth piece, right? And here's what I want to call out, right? Yeah, your dad had a good job, did probably very well, but they're still not going to be. I mean, look at the area they live in, because they still live in Flint, correct?
Yeah. So how much is the property value?
Yeah. How much are they going to leave you? And if they were to die, they're not going to die tomorrow, but if they were to die tomorrow, like, what are they going to leave you? What's going to help catapult you into that next economic level of wealth, right? There's not a whole lot there for you. So it's not like your life's going to be 1,000 times better if they pass away tomorrow.
Yeah, comparatively speaking, you're 100% right. If we're talking about generational wealth and we're talking about money. So I said earlier, going way, 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 way back, when I look at racism, you know, I look at it as being a disguise for greed, you know, money, greed, power, greed. Because if you go back, man. The people who were, you know, slave traders and all that, man, those people who funded those operations and said, oh, yeah, you're going to America. You know, here's a boat and here's some supplies and here's some people. Man, that costs money, man. So when you're talking about generational wealth, man, generational wealth, if you ask me, is what keeps this whole thing going. Because the people who had 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 generations deep money, those are the people. So going back to the whole some of us thing about everybody getting affected, not everybody's getting affected. I believe that the people who, like I said, 5, 6, 7, 8 generations back, wealthy, the old money, they're making a killing off of racism. And that's why racism won't ever go away. Because them motherfuckers ain't going to let it go away because it's making them too much money.
A month or so ago, I had opportunity to go to DC and go through the African American History Museum. And that's what they call it. Have you ever been there?
I have not.
Man, it's if anybody's in DC, make sure you go to that. The only other feeling I've ever had in a museum as heavy as I've had it in that museum was when I went to the Holocaust Museum in DC as well. Which is another, like, for what it is, that's also another very sobering experience, right? For those who haven't been there. But we were there for 4 hours. We got through like 3 of the 7 floors. They start off like right at the beginning of the slave trade in the 1400s. Then talk about that. There's a quote there, and I'm going to get the quote wrong, and I don't have a picture of it. But it basically says, you know, we've done this because we love our rum and our sugar.
I've read that quote.
Yeah, it was right there as you start, and then you just walk through. But like you're saying, looking at the wealth and, you know, the generational wealth that's happened through the slave trade and the beginning of the start of our country, even before when it was just the colonies, right? There's a lot. It was just crazy to walk through and just look at, you know, because it wasn't cheap, right? There was a lot, and a lot of the enslaved people were treated as property, right? And cargo, and looking at how much cargo in that sense was lost during each trip. And then the crazy part that we learned there, which is bonkers, is then they had insurance out for the cargo, so they'd get paid by the insurance companies for however many of the enslaved people that died in the transport. It's absolutely crazy when you look at it from an economical perspective of how racism has been so pervasive in our history. And it floors me. Again, it's a very sobering experience. If you ever go, take your time for anybody listening, because it's going to take some time and spend the time to walk through it. Because there's a lot you can learn as far as what you see happening today and how, again, history, we're stupid as people. We just continue to repeat the same history over and over. It might look a little different, but it's there if you look for it.
You ain't wrong, Joe. What I realized maybe 2 or 3 years ago, to your point about the insurance, some of our largest insurance companies and bank are as large as they are because they collateralized enslaved humans. They insured enslaved humans. still to this day, not saying that they do it today, but the reason why they're as large as they are is based on that period of time. So that's why I say, man, the money machine just keeps on rolling. So yeah, you're not making money off of, you know, collateralizing enslaved humans or floating loans on enslaved human collateral, but the systems that are in place still make it so that those companies are still making big money. Because you think about it, what are the biggest industries that you can think of? Automotive, insurance, finance. Moral of the story is these are huge companies generating a bunch of money that still might have, I don't know, 10%, 5%, you know, African Americans working in those spots. But man, they've made a killing and continue to make a killing. And not to say that the people at the top, you know, really know what's going on. And at the same time, though, nobody's going to look into changing something that generates that much money too hard, if at all.
Yeah. Yeah. The systems themselves, right? And again, you go back to, because you have a personal connection with Flint, but look at that. Like, why didn't they want to do anything about that? Right? It's going to cost them too much. Because at that point, they had to change the entire infrastructure, the whole water delivery system.
Structure.
All of it. That costs a lot of money, and nobody wants to pony that up. And so they're just like, can we find some other way to do it? Well, no, because you're poisoning people. It baffles me that when humanity comes into effect, that we still look and say, well, how much does this humanity cost?
Exactly, man. Man, they were charging people. They were still sending water bills to people. They were still sending water bills to people. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? I can't use the water. And you're sending me a freaking water bill? Are you out of your mind? Again, money. It's insane, man. It's insane. And that's why I say, you know, and Joe, I'm one of the most optimistic people that you're probably going to find. And you know this. And I believe it's too much money involved for this thing to go away. And they keep people and the system is as such that the people are united to be able to come together and actually force a change. And historically, we know when people come together, it changes. Civil rights movement, Voting Rights Act movement, that happened in 10 years because people came together. You keep people divided. And I want to throw this at you. But if you keep people divided, then it's just business as usual. You just got to keep people yelling at one another on Facebook and, you know, distracted on this, that, and other thing. As long as the people are divided and uneducated, it's business as usual. You don't even have to work that hard at it.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And those who are speaking out, if you can keep them feeling like they're kind of all alone as well, right? That they don't have a community, that there's not other people out there talking like they are. It's interesting you say that because I'm not the only one. I don't post a lot on social about this. I post enough to know that I get silenced a lot. And not that they take my post down, but just nobody sees them, right? And I have other friends who are really heavy in anti-racism work and stuff like that where they complain all the time. They're like, my posts aren't getting to anybody because it's very thick, right?
The algorithm, they talk about bias in that being programmed in the algorithms. That's a thing.
Yeah, 100%.
But see,
but we can't be quiet about it, right? I mean, we got to keep speaking up because if we're quiet, then what?
Joe, we got to get, man, if you ask me, I'm telling you, history has shown, get out from in front of damn computer and get out, organize and get out, man. That's what works. So Joe, when I did my TEDx talk, I was the shiny new penny here in Columbus, Indiana, you know, and everybody wanted me to speak about the thing, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you're hip to the Unitarian Universalist.
I have heard of them, yes.
Didn't know. Very active in civil rights.
Yeah, actually, someone gave me an article that was on their website. I'm like, well, this person's actually speaking logic. Where is this coming from, right? I went on and found it. It was from their website. I'm like, oh, wow, this is an interesting organization.
So I do a talk at the Unitarian Universalist Church. Fascinating way of how they go. It's not your normal liturgy, so to speak. I get done my talk and this Asian guy, he runs up on me and he shoves a microphone in my face and he's like, well, usually after we get done with when a speaker comes and we get done, we have a discussion afterwards. And I'm like, oh, nobody told me that. I'm like, okay.
You're like impromptu. Good. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, impromptu. So I sit down and Joe, these are old schoolers. I mean, they're old schoolers. So the first thing that they get to talking about is, well, when we marched, well, when we organized, well, when we did. And so we go through this dialogue. Long story short, they're like, we want to be active. We don't know what to do. And I said, that's so interesting. The young folks, they don't say that. And I wonder if it's because they really don't have any context other than what they read in a history book or see in a YouTube video. These old schoolers, because they were in it. They were in it, Joe. They know you got to get out there and do something, but they want to get out there and do something. But just like I said earlier, there's no figurehead. There's no leader who says, okay, let's get this shit organized. This is what the outcome is going to be. Let's go. That's what they don't have. But they have that spirit, though, of I'm going to get out there in a wheelchair. I'm going to get out there on a cane. I'm going to get out there on a walker. They don't care because they know that's how you got to do it, Joe. And that's, man, we can talk about this on podcasts and on social media all we want to. But at the end of the day, we got to get out there and do. We got to get out there. The money. We got to pool our resources together. We got to be organized and we got to get out there. And we got to do things, man. That's the only way that changes, bro. The only way it changes, because history has already shown us that's how it works.
Like you can't legislate it. You can't, like, you have to get out there and you have to show we need to be taken serious. Otherwise, they're just like, close you out. They turn it off. They do whatever. And they're like, this is just the voice of dissent. Who really cares?
100%. I'll tell you this, Joe. Here in Columbus, Indiana, the guy who started Cummins, J. Irwin Miller, they love this guy here. Do you know this man? He funded and helped organize the March on Washington, lobbied Kennedy and Johnson for the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and shut down a Cummins plant in South Africa and was like, oh, y'all want to do that apartheid thing? Well, I'll just shut down my plant until you figure it out. And if you need a little extra motivation, I'm going to talk to my homeboys over here and lay some economic sanctions on you so that you really get the message. That's what money does. That's what organization does. Man, I'm going to say it till the day I die, man. That's the only way this thing changes, man. It takes money. What did the boycotts do? Hit them in their pocketbook. Oh, we're going to sit in the back of the bus? We'll walk. We ain't going to give you our money. You ain't trying to feed us food? Okay, that's fine. We'll just lock ourselves up to the counter. Now what you going to do? Joe, you got me cranked up. Is that kind of activity, man, that is going to make the difference? And I'm not talking off the top of my head on some random stuff that I don't know. History has illustrated. Those are the methods that work. You hit them in the wallet. You use your financial wherewithal to fight that system. You organize, you come together as a united front with clear goals, and things happen in 10 or 11 years. Things happen, man. History has shown us that.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing too is getting more of, as you call them, the European Americans, the white people involved in the process as well. Right? Getting us to care about it. Because,
Miller,
again,
European American, he saw a need in the world that he believed and executed on. I got enough money and enough influence and enough connections to where I can just call up Kennedy and be like, hey, bro, what you trying to do about the Civil Rights Act?
Yep, 100. And that's what I'm saying. Like, these be more outspoken, especially white men. We don't speak out enough. I mean, that's one reason why I started this show, right? This podcast, because I'm like, there is a need. Nobody's talking about this. I was actually on a podcast. It's been like a year, maybe 2 years ago. And at the end of the podcast, we talked about money, right? And my coaching, and he did something similar to what I do, but with a different group. And we had a fun time. He talks about money through comedy at the end of it. After the recordings were off, we were waiting for things to, you know, finish out. He's like, you know, I saw you talk about money and racism. He's like, I kind of wanted to talk to you about that. But he's like, I don't know if we're the right people to talk about that, you know, because we're two white guys. And I just looked at him. I said, if we don't talk about it, who will? Because the African-American community has been speaking about it for a long time and we don't listen. But maybe if somebody who looked like them started talking about it, maybe the white community would start listening and start actually doing something. So I'm with you, Ant, 100%. There needs to be more action. There's not enough action. There's too much talking. There's like, oh, maybe we can do this. Maybe we can do that. There's not enough action that's happening. I mean, again, back to our conversation from earlier, the George Floyd stuff. The whole world got behind that. But what changed? I mean,
exactly.
And there were protests for weeks. But weeks. What changed?
Weeks, man.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, some people got educated and some laws changed, but not enough to enact real change. And I know real change takes sometimes a long time to happen, but does it? I think we use that as an excuse not to do anything.
I 100% agree with you on that, Joe. I do. Well, and there's the individual efforts that we can actually even do on our own. So, for example, I was in a book club and, you know, because book clubs were pretty popular around that time. We read How the Word is Passed. Have you read that one?
I haven't. I've heard of it, though.
Okay. Do you remember what the premise was?
I don't.
The Cliff Notes version is African-American cat, writer said, you know what? I'm going to go to all the plantations in America and just document my experience with the people who were the curators or the tour guides, visitors, whatever. It's actually a good book. Some very interesting perspectives. So two stories come from this. So one, the author, he talked about going visiting Monticello and was talking about how, you know, people go, you know, European American folks, they'll pull up and they'll be like, oh, Monticello. And the author was talking about how some of the African American guys would be like, yeah, and about Sally Hemings and all of the slaves and all that. And people like all aghast and everything, right? Because that doesn't get put into the history books. George Washington was the founding father and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And nobody talks about that. Damn near all of the founding fathers owned, enslaved, had enslaved, and they enslaved human beings. You know, so nobody talks about that. So there's that part of it.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about the money and how the banking systems, some of the banks that we know have grown because of that phenomenon. In the book, it talks about how J.P. Morgan Chase is one of those banks. So I remember one of the leaders in the book club, he's all aghast and everything, shocked. And he's like, I can't believe that I have to look at my Chase credit card different now. Joe Burns, I looked at that dude and I was like, what do you got to look at? I was like, if you that cranked up about it, this is what you do in case you don't know. Pay off the car, chop it up, send a letter to Chase and be like, you know what? This is why I ain't getting down with you no more. And hopefully you make some sort of effort, some sort of change, whatever. Now, if he did those things, is it going to really hurt Chase's pocketbook much? No. It's still an illustration of something that we can do as individuals as a form of protest. To be like, man, look, you know, you got to own up to your history. So imagine if he did it and I don't know how many people bank with Chase, but let's say, I don't know, say a million people did. Let's say 750,000 said, you know what? Just like how they boycotted the lunchrooms and the buses and everything. We taking out our money. You don't have no deposits no more. Now what you going to do? I bet you Chase would start figuring out what they could do to right that wrong. But again.
Yeah. Until it hits them financially, then no one's really, and that's good, I think, for everybody. No one's really willing to make a change. It's hard. Change is hard.
You ain't wrong.
You know, until it affects them personally, then they're like, eh, do I want to do the work required? Right. There are some people out there who really do want to do the work required to get there. There's a lot 100%. Of people who are like, ah, this is too hard.
100%. And shout out to the people who are fighting a good fight, so to speak. You know, the people who are, I mean, literally at ground level, you know, even the people who are trying to get involved in, you know, the political system here in Columbus. There's a bunch of African-Americans running for stuff like city council, treasurer, things like that. And, you know, as we start rolling up on the end, Joe, I want to just encourage people, you know, another way that they can make change is to get involved locally, because people can affect change at the local level a whole lot easier than at the national level. You know, somebody like a J.I. Miller, like I say, he could pick up the phone and call JFK and be like, yo, what are you going to do about Civil Rights Act? But I mean, most of us ain't got it like that. But
we don't have those connections, right?
We don't have those connections. But, you know, locally, we can say, hey, I'm on city council, or hey, I'm on the Civil Rights Commission. Or, hey, I'm on a housing authority board. Or, hey, I'm treasurer. So the gatekeepers, some of the traditional gatekeepers, can be usurped, and some small changes that can turn into big changes, if they're sustained, can happen at the local level, which then bubbles up to the state level. It bubbles up to the national level. You know what I'm saying? So there are things that people are doing in the government. And, you know, like I say, you know, the guy like John Lewis, look at what he's done in the time that he was in the government. You know, so there are ways that we can make change. And I'm shouting out to the people who are out there on the streets who are doing those things to do that. And man, we just need more. I mean, that's the bottom line. We need more. We need numbers. You know, we need organization. We need money. I watched a show on Netflix. It's not on there anymore, but it was talking about the 60s and how guys like Sidney Poitier, you know, some of those actors who were accepted by the masses, and they were talking about how they would send some of their money, you know, some of their earnings. Harry Belafonte was one of them. That was the guy I was trying to think of. They were talking about how, you know, the money they would make, that they would give to the cause and whatnot. And they were talking about how they had to sneak the money around. They couldn't just Venmo that shit, right? They had to drive. And, yep, you know, the police back then, two melanated guys in a car late at night, what you doing out on the road, darky? And, oh, you got a big old sack of money. They were literally risking their lives. But one of the things that struck me was, I want to say it was Harry Belafonte who said it. He said it was only until the white folks got involved that the civil rights movement actually gained momentum and turned the corner. And if you think about the brilliance of it, when they were doing those marches and they were on TV, folks were like, oh, that's terrible that the Negroes are getting beat up. But until some of the white folks got beat down, yep, they got the fire hose and they got
all
the
dog changes, hose, right?
Sudden it's a problem.
Yep. Yep. That is a problem. Because then people like us are also getting, like, that look like us, right, I should say, are starting to get beat up as well. So, oh, maybe then they can come after us, right? The whole psychology behind it is just so warped.
Bro, that's a great place to, like, get on the almost end of it. Again, it's the mental game, Joe. It's the mental game, man. Like you said, the psychology of it. I hate to say it, and I'm going to say it anyway. Racism is the most diabolically ingenious system ever created, if you ask me.
Yeah. I mean, look at all the harm it's caused and continues to cause.
And all the money it's made.
Yep. And the division, and like, it's just, yeah, there's, it's such a layered problem, right? And the narrative, the solution in an altruistic way is pretty easy. Just treat everybody like actual human beings and then treat them, you know, with kindness and respect. But that's too much for almost everybody. So yeah, we'll have to just keep, I don't know, chipping away at the issues. And one day, maybe my grandkids or their grandkids or who knows when, we can maybe resolve some of this.
You know, Joe, I love that optimism. Like I said, if we remain divided and selfish, nothing will change, man. Nothing will change. Nothing will change. You know, you figure, how is it that enslaved Africans were on these plantations, what, 200-300 deep, and there's like, I don't know, 5-10 people, you know, on the plantation? I think to myself, why didn't they just bum rush them cats? You know what I'm saying? Why didn't they just bum rush them? And again, it was, you know, plant those seeds of dissension. And, you know, hey, you know, we'll put you up in the house. We'll keep you in the field. We'll keep y'all at each other. We'll separate the men from the women and the kids. Just separation and division and keeping people uneducated. It's those simple things. If we could just overcome those, we can make a huge difference. But man, it's not happening.
It's hard. It's hard when it's such micro movements, right? And we're not seeing large movements. And when we see, again, back to George Floyd, when we see protests and unification that was so big, yet so little came from it, it starts to be a little disheartening and being like, you know, can we actually reverse this? Can we actually do something about it? Because that feels so big. The response to that, yet again, we got so little out of it. it can be disheartening. And, you know, that's, I guess, part of the fight, right? To ever be the optimist, because I'm that way too, right? I'm like, man, there's something we can do. We can get this. Maybe if we do this one more thing, maybe if we just like get more people involved, like, you know, ever the optimist, and it's sometimes my own downfall, but I got to believe in the goodness of people and humanity, and that the more, like you're saying, educated we can become, the more action we can take, because I think that's important as well, that we can start to at least chip away at the atrocities and the things that have been done and start to right some of the wrongs. As my generation, as me here as a white man in America, I didn't cause this problem, but I have the responsibility to do something about it because I'm here now and I understand and I know, right? And that's really, I think, one reason, again, why I created this show, right? Bring light to it, bring people's stories here, and hopefully inspire at least one other person to start doing some good. And if we can do that, then who knows? I'm with you. It feels like a long, steep climb sometimes, that just like, are we ever going to get to the top?
Got to keep hope alive, man. Just got to keep hope alive. And I think, you know, the call to action, piggybacking off of what you said, you know, folks get educated, organized, and take action, rinse and repeat, then we have a chance.
Yeah, I like that. And it's been so good to like talk to you about this. It's been such a good conversation. And I can't believe the time's up. We've been talking for an hour and I'm like, wow, let's keep going.
Yeah, I know. We got at least another good hour in us. I guess I'll have to come back.
It was a good conversation. So what words of wisdom and anything else you want to leave with them before we sign off here?
I said it. Keep hope alive. Number one, get educated, get organized, take action. That's my plea. That's my call to action. That's my encouragement.
I love that. It's just simple steps, right? I mean, it's not that it's easy to do, but it's pretty simple steps.
Exactly. Yeah, not that. Easy to do. Simple steps. Exactly.
Yeah. I love that. Also, how can people find you? Like if they want to like get to know you? I know we didn't talk about your professional career or anything like that. You know, as he did mention, he is a TEDx speaker.
Yeah, they could definitely just Google Ann Blair TEDx talk, the access code. That'll pull that up for people who want to get an idea through my thought process of the liberation of African Americans, but really the liberation of people at large in general. So they can find me on there. They can just Google Ann Blair. Just go to Google, type in ANTBLAIR. All this stuff come up.
That's all you. There you go. Get yourself out there.
Yeah, awesome. Man, for sure. I appreciate you. Joe, for, you know, for having me on and for being willing to hop in the deep end of the pool.
You bet, man. Like you said at the very beginning, you always push me to think differently, which is what I appreciate. And you're not willing to hold back, which I also appreciate. You know, I've had conversations where people are like holding back. I'm like, I might get hurt. I might wrestle with my own internal emotions, but that's not your problem. Let me have it. Let's go there. Let's have good conversation and let's just figure it out. Because if not, then how am I going to grow? How can I challenge my own beliefs, my own thought processes? Because that's really what this is about, right? Like I said earlier, right? It's about me challenging my own fragile beliefs in a way that I can see something different so I can do something different. So that's what I'm here about.
Keep on doing it different, brother.
Yeah, let's get it. Thanks again, Ant. And for those listening, I hope you enjoyed this episode and wait for the next one. It'll be out soon. Thanks all.
Keep tuning in.
Thank you for joining us on Money and Racism. We hope we left you with something to think about. If you like the conversation, make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget, please leave a review. To find out more about the psychology and emotion of money, visit www.josephmburns.com. And if you or someone you know would be a great guest for the podcast, email me at podcast@josephmburns.com. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world.